Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Raymond Rivas, and this is Syndicated News. I'm Raymond F. Rivas, Chief Financial Editor. The name of my firm is the Atherton Wealth Planning. And you may email me at raymond.rivas@lpl.com. You're listening to Syndicated News, syndicatednews.net, brought to you this evening by Shadow Operations, LLC. And now we have a special guest this evening, one of the most famous wineries in the world. Eileen Crane will be our featured guest, and she is the founding CEO and the founding winemaker of Domaine Canaris, I said a world-famous winery in the Napa-Sonoma area. I'm looking forward to tonight's guest, as she is a very special person who I've spoken to several times, and I think you'll find her a treasure. Eileen, are you there?
I certainly am, Raymond. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing really well, and we're just so thrilled to have you on this evening, because as I was saying earlier to my listening audience, it's a world-famous winery, and one that's just an absolute joy to go in and see and sampling all those wonderful wines. Tell me a little bit about the Domaine Canaris Winery.
Well, Domaine Canaris Winery, and probably many of you out there have actually seen it. It's the beautiful chateau on Highway 121, which is the road that connects the town of Napa to the town of Sonoma. It's the big chateau that sits up on top of the hill, kind of holding court over the region or appellation of Carneros. I was hired in 1987. I had just finished building another sparkling wine house. And Champagne Taittinger, the founders of Champagne Taittinger, the French company, or as they say, Taittinger, hired me to build Domaine Canaris, get it up and running, staffed and develop vineyards. And I'd always been in sparkling wine, so I was kind of a logical choice for that job. And over the years, Domaine Canaris has grown and flourished. When we started, we were sparkling wine. That's everything that we did was sparkling, as does Champagne Taittinger in France. But as in 1992, we did a little bit of an experiment with Pinot Noir. We became rather well known for our Pinot Noir as well as our sparkling wine. Domaine Canaris is not a particularly, the location is striking, and we certainly are well known. So many people have seen us or sat on our terraces or in our salon, but it's actually a relatively small winery. It's probably the second or third smallest sparkling wine house in California.
In your opinion, what makes Domaine Canaris such a truly a magical place?
A number of things that actually feed into that. One is people see us from the highway and they think it's this beautiful chateau, or at one point someone thought that it was a hotel. It looks so like classically proportioned old-style hotel. But when you go up the main staircase, very beautiful,
mm-hmm.
and look out
and
over...
I've been there.
So you can probably tell your listeners better than I can what makes
it
so magic.
I got to tell you, when we go up those stairways and see all those beautiful shrubs and the little fountains that you've got and the explanation about your wonderful facility, it's thrilling. I've seen people coming up and down the stairs, people who are getting married, people are just taking photographs, people just awed, and including myself. We just have such a wonderful time every time we go up there. How did you pick this special place? I mean, it sits up on, it's almost majestic looking. Who picked that wonderful location?
Well, I'd like to take full credit for it, but unfortunately, the location was determined before I was brought into the position. In fact, I used to drive by that location and think, if I ever build my own winery, that's the spot I would like to have. And I was so disappointed when I found that Taittinger and some of their partners were going to put in a facility there. I thought, well, I should have moved faster. Position on the hill of the winery was determined my first day on the job, and I had the partners, and it's not only Champagne Taittinger, but some partners from the East Coast, and we were all together, and we decided we didn't want it to be right at the top of the hill. That seemed too kind of pompous, too heavy, too high. But we wanted it high enough so you could actually look out and have a wonderful view from there, particularly the wonderful winery lake that's across the street from us, and kind of a view of the happens.
Well, I've been there on that on your terrace, and just looking out, you know what I'm talking about, that beautiful view, and it's truly an experience. It's almost, I hate to put it in these terms, but it's almost, when I said the word magical, even that word doesn't give the full meaning of what you feel when you're up in this gorgeous, gorgeous terrace. When wine lovers are on that Highway 12, 121, what do you think draws them to your winery? I mean, you're just driving along, just meandering along. Do you find people come there specifically for your winery, or they just see this beautiful chateau that kind of sits up almost in the clouds? What do you think draws most people there?
I think it's both. I think when we first opened our doors, I think it was just a little bit of Europe, or kind of it captures your imagination that you can go into a chateau. A chateau, of course, is a little palace. And I think that captures people's imagination. I think now many people have had our wines, and we do produce award-winning wines. For instance, the Domaine Crenares by Taittinger Brut Vintage, they just received 92 points, and the other two wines in that category both cost $100 or more, and this is a product that sells for $26. So I think it's the value that people come and they know that it's a great value. It's a great place to sit out on those terraces and have wine. They've had friends refer them. As you said, you and your wife have sat out on our terraces and you've probably told friends. And so it's word of mouth. It's recognizing the sign that says Domaine Crenares and people have had the wine. Or it's just simply seeing the chateau on the hill. I think all of those ways are ways that draw people in to Domaine Crenares. And I think once you get there and you see those vistas, and we've really tried to, our staff is, I think, some of the friendliest staff. The winery is rather formal and very elegant, very pretty, but people have told us over and over again that we have some of the most welcoming staff. And you
That's
can sit down and...
true.
Well, thank you.
True.
And so many places you go visit a winery and you have to belly up to the bar, or you have to take a tour to taste wines. You have to do this, you have to do that. Domaine Crenares, we are all there about the pleasure of the visit. And if you get to that terrace and you say, I'm not going to go inside and take a tour. I don't want to I want to sit here and have this very friendly server take care of me. You can absolutely do that. If you want a tour, you can do that. If you want to stand at a bar and try a sampler of our different wines, you can do that. There are lots and lots of choices for you. But it's kind of, you can create your own experience. There are very few should or have to's once you get to Domaine Crenares. I think people really appreciate that. If you just want to sit there on the terrace for an hour drinking sparkling wine and talking to your best friend, your honey, or new friends, or whatever, you can do that.
Who designed the chateau? I mean, did you was on the spot? Was it from France? Who came up with this gorgeous design? And could you give our listeners a little bit of a feel as to what it looks like? If you can capture kind of that magic that the beautiful chalet looks like, did you help design it? Did it come from France? Where did that come from?
It comes from a number of places. One is the Taittingers. Claude Taittinger's family has a country estate, which is an historic chateau just outside of Epernay. And it's called the Chateau de la Marqueterie. And that was the inspiration for Domaine Crenares. In fact, people who come to Domaine Crenares, who've been to the Chateau de la Marqueterie, will say, oh, yes, the Marqueterie. But the actual working drawings, because the Marqueterie is a two-bedroom home, it's a good-sized two-bedroom home, but Domaine Crenares is a fully functioning winery and substantially bigger. So it was redeveloped or reconfigured for a winery building by local architects up in St. Helena Valley Architects. When I was hired to do the interior layouts and to oversee the interior design and development. So it was a consortium of people who worked on creating what is today Domaine Crenares, and it goes on. For instance, one of the big things we're talking about is how can we improve the landscape, make it more, it's quite impressive, but we want it to be even more beautiful and more impressive. I think that comes from the great team that works there. We're always looking for the next stage about how to improve the guest experience. What are we going to do to make this more fun, more beautiful, more comfortable. And in fact, that's what I was doing today at the winery. We sat down and, as a group, brainstormed, how can we make this better?
I must ask you, when you tell people you're the CEO of of this beautiful, beautiful place, when you're in San Francisco, or you're with friends who don't know you that well, and say, "Well, I am the CEO of Domain Canaris," what's the reaction that you get?
Well, I don't usually tell them I'm the CEO. I guess because I came through winemaking,
uh-huh.
And my background. My father actually worked on Wall Street. He headed the international department for Dean Witter in the 1950s, wrote their market newsletter, started their option department out of Chicago. So I come from a financial family.
Mm-hmm.
I ate finance for dinner for the first 18 years of my life. But my father had an avocation, which was wine. He became very interested in wine. He was landed on D-Day, and during the Second World War, while he was in France and later Germany, he became interested in wine. He brought that interest home. And as a child growing up, he would tell me the stories of where the bottles came from. I'd look at the labels. And from a relatively young age, he would let me taste the wine. I've developed a palate. By the time I got to college, I was kind of the dorm guru, and people would come and get me on Thursday night to help them pick out their wine for their seduction dinners on Friday night. And I was in New Jersey, and the drinking age in New York State was 18, and we, of course, all knew where that state line was. I wasn't doing anything illegal. It was perfectly okay in those days to buy wine, and But I had a whole coterie of people who were very interested in learning about wine, having wine be a part of their experience. And I had a couple of other careers first before I went into winemaking. Being a winemaker was not a career option when I grew up in New Jersey. In those days, women were nurses or secretaries or teachers
uh-huh.
or librarians, but they weren't winemakers, and I didn't know any winemakers. And I had a couple of careers first, and then I finally went to the Culinary Institute in Hyde Park, New York, one summer, and I met a real-life winemaker, and he said, "You can study winemaking in California at a place called Davis." And the light went on. The minute he said that, I knew that was for me. So I slipped into winemaking that way, yes.
So did you attend the University of California, Davis?
I did, but only for about 4 months. And actually, the most important thing about attending that university was the third day I was there, I met the man I'm married to happily for 31 years. But I did. I also took classes for 4 months, and I made a lot of good contacts. And it gave me, I think, the guts to go and apply for a job in the wine industry. And my first job in the wine industry was as a tour guide. I was a tour guide and part-time tour guide. Actually, I almost starved that summer, but I worked. Yeah, almost. And then I finally ended up being in their pastry kitchen at this winery, and eventually there was a position opened in the laboratory, and I moved to the laboratory. And
you've been all over.
I have, but all of those different jobs in the industry prepared me for this job, because sometimes an employee will say, "You don't know how hard it is to give tours all day," and I say, "Oh yes, I do."
Oh yes, you do. I'm going to cut away just for a moment. I need to identify our station.
Excellent.
This is Syndicated News, and I'm Raymond F. Rivas, Chief Financial Editor, and the name of our firm is Atherton Wealth Planning here in Atherton, California. And you're listening to Syndicated.net, brought to you by Shadow Operations, LLC. And now back to our very special guest, Eileen Crane. Eileen, I've read that your wines bear the Canaris appellation. What exactly, explain to our listeners, what exactly does the word appellation mean, and why is it important?
Well, appellation, for those of you who took French 101, you remember learning probably in the first 15 minutes of class, je m'appelle, my name is. Appel, to call. And And the Appalachian is a region. It's a call out. It's a name of a place. And an Appalachian is the name of a place that's important in winemaking. So there are Appalachians all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
There are Appalachians in Italy, such as Chianti is an Appalachian or region. Champagne is an Appalachian or a region. Bordeaux is an Appalachian or a wine region. In California, we have Appalachians or wine regions, and some of them that are well-known might include, well, certainly Carneros is a well-known Appalachian, one of the oldest in the U.S. system. Napa Valley is an Appalachian. Howell Mountain is an Appalachian. Russian River is an Appalachian. Sonoma Valley is an Appalachian. So those are wine Appalachians. And there's a federal designation, and it's based on similarity of climate and soils. It's based on historic regions.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on a set of qualifications around that this region makes sense and has integrity as a grape growing and winemaking regions. And most Appalachians are known for something. Carneros is known for Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. They're famous for
Chardonnay
Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm. If you go up the Napa Valley, they're famous for their Cabernet Sauvignon. And if you go into Sonoma Valley, they're famous for their Sauvignon Blanc. So different
mm-hmm.
regions have different fame for different types of grapes. Now, I've mentioned that Carneros is famous for their Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And it
mm-hmm.
just so happens that Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are the two grapes of fine sparkling wine. And that fine sparkling wine could come from places like Carneros, like Champagne, like Russian River, like Anderson Valley, California. Anderson Valley, California. And so these different regions, and the one thing that these regions known for the Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and sparkling wine is they're cool regions. Chardonnay and Pinot Noir likes to ripen slowly. Why is slow ripening important? I'll use a little analogy. If you've ever had a hothouse tomato that's been forced to ripen too quickly, it doesn't have much flavor. But something that has slowly vine ripened is just redolent with flavor. Two things money can't buy, true love and homegrown tomatoes. I think there's a song about that. The other thing that money can't buy is Pinot Noir and Chardonnay from hot regions. Of quality. You can buy Chardonnay and Pinot Noir grown in hot regions, but it won't be of the quality of the Chardonnay and Pinot Noir that comes from cool regions or Appalachians like Carneros.
Well, Eileen, I've read that you've said that making great wine is a passion. Just by listening to you, I think that from you I'm hearing making great wine is a passion. And then you said that there is no formula. You have to be attuned to the rhythm of the grapes, the pulse of the wine. Is that your philosophy?
Yes, and I would use a food analogy. You know,
mm-hmm.
when you go to kind of a mid-range restaurant or a mid-range restaurant that's perhaps a chain or something, there's a formula, there's a recipe, and often the chains will follow, all of them will follow the same recipe. You know what you're going to get, but what you don't get is a great chef on the spot who looks at what comes in that day and says, this salmon is so perfectly fresh, I'm going to put only the merest hint of a sauce or seasoning on it because I want the salmon to show through. Or this is fattier salmon, it doesn't need a sauce because of that. Or because it's less fatty, it does. So it's the chef on the spot making the call, looking at the ingredients, and understanding how to maximize the quality of those ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And chef de cuisine is the what they call the chef in the kitchen in France. And
mm-hmm.
chef de cave, or the head of the cave or the cellar, is what a winemaker is called in France. It's the chef. It's the person, the winemaker, who's on the site without a formula, who looks at the grapes coming in and says, these grapes, this year, we have to handle them a little bit differently because of this issue. So someone has to be there. And I start in late July, early August, looking at the vineyard, tasting the grapes, tasting a sample of the juice made from the grapes. And I'm starting to, in my head, I'm starting to think, how can I make the best wine from these grapes? This year, they're higher in acid. This year, they're lower in acid. This year, I'm looking at early flavor development. What am I going to do about that? And then once I get them in the tank, I can't use a formula. I have to think, oh, this isn't quite reacting the way I thought. What do I do? Need to do next? But having said that, I think a great winemaker, like a great chef, is always looking to maximize the quality of the ingredient, the ingredient, the element, for the winemaker, the grapes, for the chef, maybe again the fresh salmon, but not to override that ingredient. If that ingredient is good, you want the flavor of that to really show through. I often think a great winemaker or a good chef de cuisine is really a babysitter. You're trying to make sure that those grapes, that wine, doesn't go astray. You're not trying to put a heavy hand on it. And the same thing in a kitchen. So you have to be attuned, as I say, to the grapes, attuned to the wine that's coming from them, and be perceptive. You know, in the financial world, it's also the same thing. A great money manager has to be attuned. They may see things going sideways, going someplace they don't want them to go, but what does that mean, and how do I play off of that to the best, you know, to the best of my knowledge? And you don't say, oh, it's going down, so we have to buy. It's going down, so we have to sell. You're saying, what is the opportunity in this market? You have to, and so all of this is being really attuned to the quality of the grapes, the quality of your ingredients, the quality of the market, and making the best decision at the moment.
Eileen, you know, it's an interesting thing. As you were making those statements, you don't know that much about me, but what I do a lot of estate planning. And so, therefore, as you would be tasting the grape, and it sounds to me, as you're tasting the grape, you realize what's in that, and you're trying to figure out, how can I make the very, very best taste from the ingredients I have? And I do the same thing in the area of estate planning. What I do, I'm listening to the client, just like you're tasting that grape. And by listening to the client, I'm envisioning in my head exactly the kind of plan that they need to have put together. And so some of these accounts are get to be $25, $30 million accounts. It's like playing a violin where we say, what do I do with this? And I know almost exactly where to push, bring what kind of experts to bring in, what kind of tax people to bring in. So as you were describing what you do with your wine, it's almost exactly what I do. Do you ever feel like a like an individual who's up there and leading the orchestra? And so therefore, as you hear the music, you know what to do to bring in the strings and bring in the horn. And so you're leading this beautiful orchestra, and you're the what's the word that they use, the maestro. And you're cooking all the ingredients in your head. You know what blends to put together, and somehow your head tells you how to do that. Is that kind of what you do also?
Yes, and it, you know, that's a good, a very good analogy, because in winemaking, you know, people, as a winemaker, I'm really only a winemaker about 2 weeks out of the year, because the harvest happens very quickly. And so, like a conductor of an orchestra, who needs to be making decisions at the moment, at the instant, has to have a feel for when is the right time to bring it in, or to bring in, you know, another section of the orchestra. When is the right time to bring in another section or clone type of Chardonnay, type of Pinot Noir, and how do you maximize the tonal qualities, whether it be a smell and aroma or the tone of the instruments. And like an orchestra conductor, there's so much practice that goes behind it. I've been making sparkling wine for 31 years. I probably have the most experience in sparkling wine production of anyone in the United States. And yet, I've only made sparkling wine 31 times. And you think about that. I was sitting next to probably the father of modern American winemaking one time, about maybe 10 years ago, Andrei Chelyachev. And he was in his 90s, and he said, he was an optimist, and he said, "Eileen, I'm probably going to die in the next 10 years." Here he is, probably 90 years old. He probably, and he did, unfortunately. But he said, "I just feel like I'm starting to get the hang of this. It's such a shame. Because it's you never stop learning about winemaking. It's always the next harvest, the next vintage, and it's always something different. And sometimes you bring up knowledge and you think, I had this same problem in 1982, and this is how I handled it. Or I saw this clone of Pinot Noir in 1978, and it worked well, and I didn't. And I think that would be perfect for that site. So you're always bringing up, in a sense, old information, but in a new way. And that's what I love about sparkling winemaking. But the other thing about sparkling winemaking is it's a wine blended of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And when I say Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, people think of one grape, one type of grape. But there are dozens of types of Chardonnay and dozens of types of Pinot Noir. Think of when you go to the stores and you have got apples on your list, but you get there and there's Max, there's Rome's, there's Delicious. You have to... And the same thing with Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. They're all these types. So when... we've just started to do this week. We've brought in all these different types of Chardonnay, all these different types of Pinot Noir, and we come up with the master blend. It's all from our own vineyards, which are all certified organic. They're all from our vineyards in the Carneros, and they're all cool climate, and we have all these different types or clones of Chardonnay, all these different clones or types of Pinot Noir. And my challenge, my job, is to put together the most perfect blend of these wines. The French call this a nose, to create the blend. And for sparkling wine, you have to create the best blend, but you can't create the best blend for the moment because... For instance, our Brut vintage, it's vintage dated. That means we always wait a full 3 years before we release it. We make a wonderful product called Le Rêve, which is repeatedly rated America's finest sparkling wine, Le Rêve meaning the dream. And that is always aged a minimum of 6 years. So when I blend these wines, I have to imagine sitting here in October of 08, what will this wine taste like on somebody's dinner table 3 years, 4 years, 6 years, 10 years from now? And it'll be the same wine that went in the bottle, except over the time it's in the bottle, it will have acquired another 1.5% alcohol as part of the sparkling wine process. Mm-hmm. It will have acquired bubbles. It will have acquired age, and just before it's released, it will have been given a dosage. And so I have to imagine all of these things. A dosage.
What's that?
A dosage is the final little addition of pure cane sugar and a wine of the same vintage that's added at the last minute to round out. Virtually all sparkling wines and champagnes have this little tiny bit of dosage added. And the dosage determines if it's going to be Brut in style, that is very low dosage, and our wines are, or if they're going to be sweeter, becoming dry, sec, which is really sweeter than a Brut, or demi-sec, only half dry, half sweet, demi-doux, or do, which is sweet. Those styles are not very popular anymore. Oh, probably 95% of all fine champagnes and sparkling wines made in the world today are the brut, the driest style.
Do you, when you start to taste these various grapes,
yes.
do you envision that in your head of exactly more of exactly what you need to do to really create that great wine? Do you just do it in your head primarily, or do you have to sit down and write it out, or do you just know?
Well, it's really created on my palate. So because I've been at Domaine Crenares now for 21 years making the wine there, it's a great luxury as a winemaker to have many years with the same vineyard strip, really learn them. So I know, for instance, which vineyard sites are probably going to go into each wine. But I get some surprises every year, so you have to be open-minded about that.
What's an example of one of the surprises that you've run into? You remember?
Yes, we have, we brought in a few years ago, we brought in for a number of years, a Chardonnay clone that we liked, but did not usually go into our Larev. And one year, it just seemed right in the Larev, and we tried it, and it worked very successfully. But subsequent years, it hasn't worked so successfully. So it was the climatic conditions of that year that pushed it to the point where it went into the Larev. It was particular conditions of the growing. So I have this concept of which clones are probably going to go into the Larev. But I also taste through all of the Chardonnay clones, because Larev's a blanc de blanc. It's all made from Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. So I taste all of the clones because something might be surprising. And as I create the blend, I may think, I need to go back to that one because I think this year that might just be the right one.
I have to cut away just for a moment for identification. I want to come back to the clones because I have never heard of a clone for wines, but let's come back to that in a moment or two. Let me just put a small break. Again, this is Syndicated News. I'm Raymond F. Rivas, the Chief Financial Editor, and the name of my firm is the Atherton Wealth Planning Company, and you can email me at raymond.rivas@lpl.com. You're listening to syndicatednews.net, brought to you this evening by Shadow Operations at LLC. And again, back to our guest who's going to discuss with us the clones of Chardonnay, and one of the most fascinating individuals I've had on this show in a long time. And I must tell you, I'm writing some of these notes down that you're talking about, and I'm beginning to feel like I'm really learning an awful lot. But the last time I felt like this, I used to hang around a pharmacy, and I thought I was a doctor. So that's a joke. But I mean, it's just like, it's so fascinating. So again, let's go back to the Chardonnay clones. And what do you mean by a Chardonnay clone?
Well, it's a complicated issue. But using the analogy of going to the supermarket and you have apples, but there are many kinds of apples and they all have different flavors. And the clones are like that. The clones have a wide array of flavors. For instance, our Pinot Noir clones range in flavor profile from rose petal, orange peel, through strawberry, raspberry, cherry, all the way down to coffee and black tea flavors. So there's an immense array of flavors in Pinot Noir clones, immense. In Chardonnay, the flavors range from minerally, lemon cream, muscat, which is a type of grape, through different aromas that you, white flowers, different aromas that you get from these clones. And by putting them together, you can build in more complexity, a more complete wine. And I often, you have these wine geeks who smell wines and they'll come up with a list of aromas, and that's fine. But you don't have to do that to really appreciate a wine. If a wine, when you smell a wine, and every wine, including sparkling mm-hmm. ones, you should smell them. Sparkling ones have wonderful aromas. And you know it's a great wine if you smell it and you think, oh, I want to smell it again. I want to smell yes. it again. It's intriguing enough that you keep going back to it. And maybe you can name the different aromas you're smelling, and maybe you can't. But if it intrigues you enough to go back and smell it again. And a great wine should also, when you take a sip, whether it be sparkling yes. wine, red wine, or white wine, mm-hmm. should mm-hmm. fill your mouth with flavors. Now, a great sparkling wine should not only fill your mouth with flavors, but it should have just a little bit of a tickle from the bubbles. Mm-hmm. The bubbles shouldn't mm-hmm. snap or pop like a soda pop. There should be a mm-hmm. little tickle, a little sensation from the bubbles. But it should be elegant, discreet. It shouldn't be like, you know, a gassed water or soda pop. And
right,
then
huh?
when you swallow, mm-hmm. when you finish tasting the wine and you swallow,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
the finish should stay with you. When we create the Domaine Carneros by Taittinger, any of our sparkling wines, or our Pinot Noirs, we're looking for balance. So a wonderful nose that takes you, that draws you into tasting the wine, and then
mm-hmm.
you taste it, and when you finish it, you can still taste it on your palate for,
mm-hmm.
you know, 30 seconds or a minute afterwards, you still
right,
think,
uh-huh.
that was delicious. So a fine wine should have all those attributes. And that's really what separates fine sparkling wine from mediocre sparkling wines.
Mm-hmm.
And vintage dating on a sparkling wine or champagne is very important, and people often don't realize that. A non-vintage sparkling wine or champagne is to be drunk when you buy it. The winemaker is telling you, drink it now. That it wasn't necessarily something they wanted to get to hold, it wasn't worth holding back for the
uh-huh.
full 3 years. Non-vintage champagnes and sparkling wine are usually released at about 18, 20 months of age. A vintage dated sparkling wine or champagne is always a full 3 years old. And so the wine we're saying, it was worth investing on holding this back this long.
Mm-hmm.
And if you choose to age it further, it will pay you further dividends. So vintage dating is very important. Also, another thing to look for is an appellation. We talked about this earlier.
Right,
but something
uh-huh.
that says California or North Coast, what does that mean? Well, I don't know, and I'm a winemaker. I mean, I know it means a huge region.
Right.
But a fine sparkling wine or champagne should have the name of their region, like Carneros, like Russian River, like
yes.
Anderson Valley,
mm-hmm.
or that one in France called Champagne. That's a region, too. So you want to look for something that has a quality, high-quality appellation, cold region, like Carneros, like Russian River, like Anderson Valley, like Champagne. That will set the merely good apart from those that are fine. And a further qualification is if you find a great region or appellation,
mm-hmm.
such as we've talked about, and it has a vintage date, it's going to be even finer. You're going to be
even that much better. You know,
even
I want you to talk about my very favorite wine that you have. And that's I think you pronounce that Le Rêve. Am I pronouncing it properly?
Well,
kind of.
You know, Le Rêve is
Le Rêve.
But
there you go.
Le Rêve, which means dream. It's French for the
yeah.
dream. But if you want to call it Le Rêve, it'll...
no, Le Rêve is I always mispronounce it. Tell me about that sparkling wine. It is just absolutely wonderful.
Well,
what makes
that,
it so special? Why is it so very special?
Well, it has a very special winemaker. Le Rêve. Which means the dream, and Champagne Taittinger, our parent company, created the first true prestige or premium Blanc de Blanc in France and in Champagne. And when I was first hired, Claude Taittinger said to me, as we have France's finest Blanc de Blanc, it's called Comte de Champagne, someday I'd like to have America's finest Blanc de Blanc. And in fact, he said, someday I have a dream to have America's finest Blanc de Blanc. And I was sitting in a construction trailer at the time and thought that was a big order, but over the years we worked on it, and by 1991, Claude Taittinger loved the blend, the cuvée that I sent him, and he said, if the wine's this good next year, we'll have our first great Blanc de Blanc. He said, and I'm going to order a special bottle for it. Mm-hmm. And then we needed to come up with a name, and I remembered that he had said, I have the dream to have America's finest Blanc de Blanc one day.
Mm-hmm.
And so hoping that that would be the case, and of course it was hoping at that point because we were
mm-hmm.
just putting it into the bottle,
mm-hmm.
we called it. By the time it was ready to be released, I think we were all pretty convinced that at least a large number of people would think it was America's finest Blanc de Blanc.
Oh,
the concept
of absolutely, absolutely wonderful.
Well, thank
you.
You
go
up
there and you pour that that glass, you know, that champagne glass with that wonderful, wonderful wine, and you go get yourself some of those chocolates, you know, from the counter. It is like you've died and gone to heaven. It is just so, so magical.
Well, and we do want people to think that they died and found heaven on earth. And, you know, that's something to talk about is that so many people think, I can only have champagne, I can only have sparkling wine for the special occasion.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, that special occasion in my book is Friday night. Because you can say it's I made it through this week. It was a week I did a good job. It was a week well lived, and also to celebrate that it's now your time. And people so often say, "I'm saving it. Why are you saving it? If you open it, the occasion will come." And you know, there's just if you go into a restaurant and order a fine bottle of sparkling wine, and I'd like to suggest Domaine Carreras by Taittinger.
Mm-hmm.
You will remember, oh, we didn't really celebrate your birthday properly. We didn't celebrate that great trade. We didn't celebrate buying our vacation home. We didn't celebrate selling it, you know, whatever it may be. But the occasion will come. But you can celebrate the little minutes in life, the moments. And so many people think, I have to save it. A good bottle of sparkling wine costs no more than a good bottle of Chardonnay. And if you look at it, glass per cup, if you buy yourself a fancy cup of coffee in the morning, it may cost you $5. And you can have a bottle of Domaine Carneros. If you've got a good champagne stopper, which will cost you about, it will be an investment about $7 or $8. If you've got one of those, you can go home and have a single glass of Domaine Carneros every night for 5 or 6 nights, and it will cost you no more than that designer coffee you had in the morning. And think about what that would feel like, going home to a glass of bubbles every night, and how good that would feel.
So how do you celebrate on Friday evenings? What do you do?
We open a bottle, and because I'm in the winemaking world, I open bottles from many, many different people. It's the way I keep my palate fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally we just come back to our favorites. You know, you want to experiment, but at the same time, if you've got a favorite, it's good to go back to that one too. And that resets your standard for what you're looking for in the other ones. And my husband and I sit down on the back deck. I think we're just moving into the fireplace at this time of year. And we sit down, and it's our time. We make a few simple hors d'oeuvres. Sometimes if we're busy, it's as simple as a little dish of nuts. Sometimes I put some smoked salmon on crackers with a little creme fraiche or sour cream. And we sit down, and we talk over the week. We have a glass or two, and we finish off the bottle with dinner. And people say,
wow,
but you don't drink it.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and
great. I do, but now you've mentioned a Claude Taittinger a couple of times. Who is Claude Taittinger, and what does that what do you mean to your winery?
Claude Taittinger.
Go ahead.
He was Claude Taittinger was the president of Champagne Taittinger until a few years ago. Now it's his nephew Pierre Emmanuel Taittinger, and both very forward thinking. Men, a lot of people say to me, how do you like working for the French? That must be awful. And I said, well, I've got the good French guys. I like to read history, and every so often someone says, oh, those French, and I think, well, you know, if they didn't show up at Yorktown, we might still be a colony. But because they did in the end. And were very gracious about it, too. They were the inspiration. They were the ones who put together the concept of Domaine Carnot's Quatanger. Mm-hmm. But I also admire them a great deal because Quatanger would say, you know, so many people from France would come over and say, no, you're going to do it this way. Quatanger said, we are now of Carneros. You are of Carneros. He said, we're not going to be able to tell you how to make this wine. We have no intention. We don't want you to be told how to make this wine. And we had, of course, I had gone through 7 interviews with them, and we talked style, so we had stylistic agreement. But he said, where would Picasso be if you were trying to imitate Renoir? He said, you never would
That's
have
true.
Heard of him.
That's
he said,
true.
Picasso needed to do his own thing to create great art. And Renoir wasn't trying to imitate the great classical. He was trying to do his own thing. Or Frida Kahlo did her own thing. And when you think of great art, you think of people who stepped out from what everybody else was doing and did something well. And Claude Tatinger was a great mentor in that he encouraged me to do that. Certainly stylistically, there's a crossover between Tatinger and Domaine Carneros. They were careful on who they hired, but once they hired me, they said, now you need to run with it. You need to do what works best for Carneros. And he understood that, and he's absolutely right. They couldn't dictate because they weren't there working with the grapes day in and day out. They weren't there working with, and so I've really enjoyed that. And Claude Tatinger, because the Champagne Tatinger, and the Tatinger name is pronounced many different ways. It's originally an Austrian name, so it would have been Taittinger, and in France it's called Tatinger. In the United States we say Tatinger or Tatinger, and Claude Tatinger always said it doesn't make any difference how you pronounce it so long as you reach for the bottle.
So in other words, you follow what in Hamlet, I think it's Act 1, when it said, a rose by any name still smells just as sweet. Is that what you mean?
I think we're coming to our first disagreement because I think that was Romeo and Juliet, but we can settle this over a bottle next time you come
exactly.
to visit Domaine. And I suggest you come back soon because this is just a fabulous time to visit Domaine Carneros.
Gorgeous day.
And in fact, there's never a bad time to visit Domaine Carneros, but this time of the year, with the leaves turning, the vineyard leaves turn colors, and it's today more than any day, I notice the color change. And if you come early, we open at 10 o'clock, sometimes you'll see the balloons, the great big hot air balloons in the air. And you can come up this time of year, it's less crowded. We're almost not further than two and a half hours maximum from any place in the Bay Area, and many places we're 45 minutes. And you can come up and have a mini vacation, a mini retreat. It's less crowded. You can get into the restaurants you want to get into, but you can sit on the terrace of Domaine Carneros and have one of our beautiful smoked salmon plates or artisanal cheese plates or... and I know what you have is a chocolate plate. We haven't officially done that, but we may name that chocolate plate for you because you seem to be the big proponent of that. But you can come.
I love that. Let's nice breakaway here for a moment or two. Let me complete this. This is Syndicated News. Again, I'm Raymond F. Ravis, a chief financial editor. You're listening to syndicatednews.net, brought to you by Shadow Operations LLC. And again, our very special guest, Eileen Crane, just a delight to listen to, and there's so much to learn. There was a question I did want to ask you, though, is about the thousands of wineries. As I understand, there's about 15 of them that are making sparkling wine. Why did you choose to stay with the bubblies?
Well, and so many people have asked me that, and it's like, what do I want in my glass? What do I love best in the whole world? Mm-hmm. And I would have to admit to you that between chocolate and a good glass of bubbly, it would be a hard choice there. Even my husband might be in that next too. But, wine, sipping on a little bit of rosé at this moment, and we make
we're sipping on
a little rosé and sparkling wine. We haven't talked about my sparkling rosé, which was just released nationally. There's not a whole lot of it, but you can find it in stores. Or, you know, so many, if you want something special from Domaine Carneros, it's out there in public, but we have a beautiful new website. It's domainecarneros.com. We have a beautiful, beautiful website. And our rosé.
So that the website, give it one more time so the listeners can look it up right after the show. What's that website again?
Domaine Carneros. DomaineCarneros.com, DomaineCarneros.com,
mm-hmm.
And we have a beautiful new website that talks about many facets of the winery. If you're really unlucky, you'll have to find out what I look like.
I have your photographs. Matter of fact, I'm looking right at it, and you're absolutely stunning. So it goes with the ambiance of this beautiful winery. So you've been making these sparkling wines for 31 years, and
I think
longer than anyone else in America. So why do you still find it so challenging?
Well, every year it's a new ball game. It's a new challenge. We talked a little bit about that there are different problems and issues, concerns, elements, things to work with, things to be delighted with every single year. I also, another part of my job is I just love seeing people sip the wine. I love being at the winery and just seeing people enjoy it. So many people think, oh, I don't like champagne or sparkling wine. It's because they've had that wedding wine. And
they've had
that stuff that's poured at so many weddings, and you think, oh, I don't like that. And that's not what. And I see people we make wonderful Pinot Noirs as well, and I'll see people sitting on the terrace, and they'll say to me, well, I don't really like sparkling wine. I'd love to try your Pinot Noirs. I said, you must try our wonderful Pinot Noirs that are classic and multi-layered and intriguing, but I'm going to pour you one of our sparkling wines, and if you truly don't like it, I'll take it away. But at least try it. And I'll see the first sip, and they'll say, oh, my goodness, I had no idea. Because Americans don't drink sparkling wine. When you go to France, if you sit down in a white tablecloth restaurant, that is something of average or better quality. Many people, maybe 50% of the restaurant, will be drinking champagne or sparkling or the house aperitif, which is a sparkling cocktail. And if you go to a really high-end restaurant, virtually 100% of the people will be. They wouldn't consider going out to a fine restaurant and not having champagne or the house aperitif, which is based on champagne or sparkling wine. So in this country, I think we think it's too decadent, but it's simply a wine. It's a wonderful wine, of course, but we haven't tried it enough, and people don't think you can drink it with food. And I have to tell you, I fell in love for the first time with a bottle of champagne and filet mignon. Now, I can't promise the same results for everybody, but it might work for you. So it doesn't. You don't have to have. Sometimes they say, oh, you have to have caviar, you have to have oysters. You don't. It actually usually goes. Our rosé sparkling wine goes well with a New York steak. It'll go with duck. It'll go with salmon. It'll go with so many dishes, and people just don't think to have it with dinner. And I know I get carried away, excuse me. But if you go out to dinner, and there are four of you at a table, and the waiter comes over and says, what would you like to drink? And someone says, can I have the wine list? And then they say, well, what are we going to have for dinner? Don't worry about it. Order a nice bottle of sparkling wine. Pour and enjoy it. And you can reacquaint yourself with your friends that you haven't seen for a few months or even a few years. You can take your time looking at the menu. And if by the end of that time you still have something left in the bottle, it's going to go with something that somebody's ordered extremely well. Somebody will say, oh, I'll have the filet of sole. Oh, I'm going to have the pasta. Oh, I'm going to have the scallops, and it will go extraordinarily well. But the truth is, there are only two things that fine sparkling wine doesn't go with: coffee and toothpaste. And that's actually important for champagne or sparkling wine, because it's the only wine you can drink three meals a day at breakfast. Think about it. Do you ever think, I'm going to sit Sunday morning, do you ever think, I'd like a nice glass of Cabernet to go with my quiche or my brunch or whatever? No. You can drink sparkling wine with three meals a day, four if you do tea.
That's true. I do have a question about something you said earlier in the show. You called yourself the nose. Why do people refer to you as the nose at the winery?
Well, because so many people think that creating a wine has to do with tasting the wine. And, of course, it does. But so much of our sense of taste comes through our nose. Mm-hmm. Our nose is far more sensitive than our palate ever will be. So when I construct, when I put all these different clones together that we talked about before, the aroma is so much of that. And then actually when you taste the wine, you taste it and you think, oh, it's what it tastes like. But so much of the taste is actually kind of the aftertaste that comes back up through the nose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for instance, our Pinot Noir, our red Pinot Noir, you know, you smell this wonderful, luscious bouquet in the nose, and it's got black cherries and blackberry and hints of black tea.
That sounds wonderful. Mm-hmm.
And spice and smoke, and you get all these things, and you taste it, and you taste the bounce, and but you also get the taste comes up back up through your nose, and that's where you get, again, the blackberries and the cherries and the, and then when you swallow it, the aftertaste or the finish also, is part of what and it really is your nose, even though you think it's your taste buds. Your taste buds play a part in it, but taste is limited to things like salt and acid and bitter and sugar. It's not all those finer things.
It sounds to me that I like to stick my nose inside every drink. I mean the various wines, because again, it's like, and then you swirl it around. I was doing it one time, and someone said, "Are you trying to show off?" I said, "No, this is where it's released, where the smells really come through, and it's almost sometimes." And maybe you do the same thing. If you could just go ahead and take in that smell and that, just enjoy it as much as possible. Well,
absolutely.
I must tell you, we have to come to a close here, and it's been a very fast 1 hour. This has been absolutely an enjoyable show.
And Raymond, I just wanted to invite everybody who's been listening this evening. Please come and visit us. As wonderful as our wines are when you buy them from the shelf or order them from the winery, you can also come and sit on our terrace, taste through the wines, watch the vines growing, or watch the wines changing color that have produced the grapes that are actually in your glass. Take your time with us. You're not going to be rushed through. It'll be a wonderful experience. No matter how many wineries you have visited, you will still enjoy this one. So thank you, Raymond, and thank you,
Eileen.
So
it's been our pleasure having you this evening. And all I can do is thank you, and it's been a wonderful experience. And all I can say is we're very fortunate to have you as our guest this evening. Again, this is Syndicated News, and we're closing. I'm Raymond F. Rivas, and my guest next Tuesday is going to be Mr. Lincoln Anderson, a renowned economist, and you can find him being quoted on the Wall Street Journal, MSNBC. And he's going to be a guest that I've been trying to have for quite a while, and it's going to be a real treat for everyone. Again, with this evening, Eileen, I want to thank you. And for Syndicated News, we're finished. I look forward to see you again next Tuesday evening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.